in the limelight.
For the first 2 years of the coronavirus pandemic through to 2021, China's growth was always positive and greater than that of the United States. China's policy not only saved lives but protected the economy. One might say, win-win. We're prepared for you an article written by John V. Walsh. Until recently, a professor of physiology and neuroscience at the University of Massachusetts, Chan Medical School. The piece is titled COVID Death Toll versus China's Puts US to Shame. May and June, two milestones were passed in the world's battle with COVID-19 and were widely noted in the press, one in the United States and the other one in China. They invite a comparison between the two countries and their approaches to combating the pandemic. The first milestone was passed on 12th of May, when the United States registered more than 1 million total deaths due to COVID-19, the highest of any country in the world. WebMD expressed its sentiment in a piece headlined, US COVID deaths hit 1 million. History should judge us. Second, on 1st of June, China emerged from its 60-day lockdown in Shanghai in response to an outbreak there, the most serious since the Wuhan outbreak at the onset of the pandemic. The total number of deaths in mainland China since the beginning of the epidemic in January of 2020 now stands at 5,226 as of 19th of June 2022. To put that in perspective, that is 3,042 deaths per million population in the US versus 3.7 deaths in China due to COVID. 3,042 versus 3.7. Had China followed the same course as the US, it would have experienced at least 4 million deaths. Had the US followed China's course, it would have had only 1,306 deaths in total. The European Union did not fare much better than the United States, with 2,434 deaths per million population as of 19th of June this year. When confronted with these numbers, the response of the Western media has all too often been denial that China's numbers were valid. But China's data have been backed by counts of excess deaths during the period of the pandemic, as the New York Times illustrated in a recent article. Actually, this is old news. The validity of China's numbers, as shown by counts of excess deaths, was validated long ago in a February 2021 study by a group at Oxford University and the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. This was published in the prestigious British Medical Journal and is discussed in detail in the United States. Clearly, China put the saving of lives above the advance of the economy with its dynamic zero-COVID policy. But contrary to what was believed in the West at the time, saving lives also turned out to be better for the economy, as shown in the numerous data from the World Bank. During the first year of the pandemic, that is 2020, China's economy continued to grow, albeit at a slower rate. In contrast, the US economy contracted dramatically, dropping all the way back not simply to 2019 levels, but to pre-2018 levels. Interestingly, the plot also shows the year that the Chinese gross domestic product based on purchasing power parity or PPP surpassed that of the United States in 2017, heralding a new era for the global South. The World Bank has not yet released data for 2021, but the International Monetary Fund, IMF, has purchasing power parity gross domestic product data for 2021. The U.S. economy grew at 5.97% compared to China's 8.02%. Unlike the World Bank data shown in a graph for the years up to 2020, these data for 2021 are not corrected for inflation, which for 2021 ran at 4.7% in the United States, whereas China's inflation rate was 0.85%. So China's growth would be even greater in comparison to the United States, where inflation taken into account. Bottom line is that for the first 2 years of the pandemic through to 2021, China's economic growth was always positive and greater than that of the United States. China's policy not only saved lives but protected the economy. One might say win-win. Is China's dynamic zero-COVID policy sustainable in the face of the Omicron variant? The period of the recent Shanghai lockdown, which we can date from 1st of April 2022, ending on 1st of June, and followed the second largest outbreak in China since the original outbreak in January of 2020 in Wuhan. Each resulted in major lockdowns. The first in Wuhan lasted about 76 days, and the second lockdown in Shanghai lasted about 60 days. The first in Wuhan was due to the original variant, and the second lockdown was due to the much more infectious Omicron variant. During the recent lockdown in Shanghai, the Western press was awash with proclamations, all too many laced with the unseemingly schadenfreude that China's dynamic zero-COVID policy was not sustainable. This is all too reminiscent of decades of predictions that China's extraordinary success in developing its economy to number one in the world in terms of purchasing power parity, or PPP, and gross domestic product GDP was a passing phase, a Ponzi scheme that was, what else, not sustainable. Recently, the same press has gone silent, always a sign that China has met with success. So what are the results? The Shanghai lockdown ended on 1st of June this year, and from that day until the day of this writing, 19th of June, there have been no deaths due to COVID-19 on the Chinese mainland. Cases nationwide are also way down to 183 per day from the peak of 26,000 on 15th of April. That was the largest number of cases in a single day for the entire period of the pandemic in China. For comparison, the peak in the United States was 800,000 in a single day. Both the Wuhan and Shanghai lockdowns demanded sacrifices and patience over the roughly two-month period for each. However, these difficulties are generally exaggerated in the West and based on anecdotes of the worst of the difficulties encountered. Such sordid journalism reaches rock bottom in a New York Times piece equating China's hard-working healthcare workers to murderers. As an antidote to this kind of hit piece and to gain a feeling of life in the cities that were under lockdown during the Wuhan outbreak, Peter Hessler's March 2020 account in The New Yorker, Life on Lockdown in China, is enlightening and will dispel many misconceptions. Peter Hessler was living and teaching in Chengdu in Sichuan province at the time. China's approach has succeeded, and the public health measures that have worked so well in mainland China should not be lightly dismissed, let alone be the subject of mean-spirited attacks. Such measures may be means of saving millions of lives when the next variant or the next pandemic strikes. Turning again to the United States, what does it say when one of the richest nations in the world, spending more than $1 trillion a year on its national security budget, could not muster the means to deal with COVID-19 and ended up with more deaths than any other nation on Earth? China's handling of the coronavirus pandemic certainly shows a completely different outcome was possible. The US death toll was not an inescapable act of nature. That being so, should there not be a people's tribunal to investigate those in charge of the US government over the course of three administrations. That is what's needed, not an official whitewash. And should not punishment appropriate for a crime against humanity be meted out? The 1 million dead Americans deserve no less.
He was a teacher.
On December 12, 1925, in a totally undemocratic move, Mr. Reza Pahlavi is appointed the king of Iran. During these days, when the world is taking a fresh breath of temporary peace after World War I, Reza Khan Mirpanch sets his sights on creating fundamental changes in Iran. Different tasks including the construction of a nationwide railway system, banning all Islamic veils, the establishment of Iran's first civil laws and other such activities, the founding of a modern education system is among the first orders of Iran's king who wears a military uniform. Only a few months after the coronation of the new Shah of Iran, the government is tasked with the development and expansion of education at the elementary level. Old schools under the supervision of clerics are shut down and replaced with schools with teachers who are not clerics and follow the guidelines of Reza Shah's Ministry of Culture. With the establishment of the General Office of Writing, drafting educational books for elementary students begin. The Shah's goal from this action is to unify school books and have direct supervision on what students are being taught at schools across the country. This supervision can be defined in one thing: nationalism and love of the Shah must be included in all school books. In early 1951, when Reza Shah's reign has come to an end and Mohammad Reza Pahlavi replaces his father on the throne, the English teacher at the biggest school in Qom, which is known as the second Dar ul Funun, is a young, well-dressed cleric who wears sunglasses, and people point him out in the streets and say that he can speak a foreign language. Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti was born in Isfahan. He was a seminary student at the Qom Seminary School and a university student at Tehran's college. He was talented and an elite student. He chose teaching to make a living. He is not financially well off, but he is very different with the rest of the seminary students. He doesn't charge anyone tuition, writes his daily schedule on a piece of paper, and hangs it up on the wall in his room. His appointments, when to chat with friends, he's even defined joking for himself. When he becomes a top student during his BA course, they propose that he either stay in Tehran and take on an official job or become a teacher in the education system. He chooses teaching and Qom. Because of his command of the English language, the education system accepts him as a teacher at Qom's Hakim Nizami High School. In his memoirs, he writes, The beginning of my political activities based on Islamic motivations is related to the year 1950, when Ahmad Qavam made his famous bullish speech, and I heard it on the radio. I left the house instinctively. It was a very interesting feeling for me. I didn't even know which direction I was going in, but I knew I shouldn't be at home. The nationalization of the oil movement and the link between Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti with struggles of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani are the beginning days of the young teacher's life, which was full of ups and downs. From then on, his presence in many of the political gatherings in Tehran becomes serious. On August 19, 1953, with the defeat of the nationalization of the oil industry through a coup d'etat, many had lost hope. But he would say, no matter what condition they create, we'll come up with a new plan for it. Our problem is that we do not have enough organized members, and we have to, under the cover of a cultural movement, train them. The same idea, training members, was a spark that helped establish the religious and knowledge of high school in Qom. It was the first school which was established with efforts of the son of the founder of the Qom Seminary, Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi, and the young Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti is put in charge of it. Now, with the establishment of the religion and knowledge school, Beheshti's extremely important and serious activities begin. Everything is done under his supervision. The school becomes one of the best schools in the country very soon. Beheshti's seriousness leads to the acceptance of all the students of the school in the entrance exam who had graduated in its first year. But his main goal in this school is training people who will play important roles in movements in the country. The entrance exam shouldn't be a preventive barrier when it comes to the students educated at this school. The mid-50s, and Sayyid Mohammad is almost 30 and successful and well-known. His organized lifestyle helps him juggle a number of activities well and simultaneously. He studies in Allameh Tabatabai's classes for 5 years, and Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammad Muhaqqiq Damad, who is strict when it comes to calling someone a mujtahid, explicitly calls him one. He also passes the Islamic philosophy doctorate exam held by Tehran University. In 1956, with the establishment of the Intelligence and Security Organization of Iran, known as SAVAK, the heavy shadow of the government casts clouds over the entire country, an organization which becomes scarier and more ghastly by the day. During these years, Beheshti comes up with a new idea: teaching modern sciences to seminary students during the night shift at the religion and knowledge school. He believes that seminary students must be educated like literature diploma holders and in being familiar with English, Arabic, and natural studies. This idea attracts about 30 seminary students interested in learning to the religion and knowledge school in its first term. Now everyone calls Sayyid Mohammad Dr. Beheshti. A doctor who, in addition to all the work and attention that he has in school, is well-read about Islamic economy, the banking system, and issues related to Islamic governance. He even exchanges views and ideas with seminary students and university professors. He sets up a group made up of Mr. Musavi Ardabili, Mahdavi Kani, Meshkini, Hashimi Rafsanjani, Mesbah Yazdi, and others, to produce a scientific and academic research regarding Islamic governance. In March 1961, unexpected news causes grief among the people. Ayatollah Brujerdi has passed away. The death of Ayatollah Brugerdi causes all the people to take to the streets. The huge presence of the people in Ayatollah Brugerdi's funeral shows off how respected the Shia clergy are among the nation. With the death of Ayatollah Brugerdi, the atmosphere of the struggle against the Shah's regime changes and the role of the Shia clergy and seminaries become more solidified. He was in Isfahan and busy visiting his relatives when he was shocked with the news of the vicious attack of the Shah's regime to Faizia school. But he cannot remain silent and sends Imam Khomeini a telegraph from the clerics of Isfahan and condemns this attack with a gentle tone. Savak doesn't even overlook this action. He is called in and forced to make a written commitment that he will not interfere in such matters again. On October 3, 1963, Savak documents show the following comments. After the incident in Qom and the arrest of Mr. Khomeini, teachers, instructors, and students in the city of Qom encounter new provocations against the government. And one of the provocateurs is Muhammad Beheshti, who has a bachelor's degree in religious studies and teaches at the above-mentioned city's religion and knowledge school. What's obvious is that students have been provoked against the government by the aforementioned individual. These provocations have been deemed effective and tangible. Savak has officially announced that naming Ayatollah Khomeini in speeches is a crime. But Beheshti ignores Savak's announcements and at the end of all of his speeches, prays for the well-being of Ayatollah Khomeini. Finally, in the fall of 1963, Savak's worrisome reports create problems for the doctor and cause his forced transfer from Qom to Tehran. But the action may not end up to be a bad thing for him, because now in Tehran, he has a larger arena to continue his activities. With the murder of Hassan Ali Mansour by the Mutalifa's military wing, more are worried about him. His friends were sure that his name was in Savak's blacklist because of the Mutalifa, known as the Islamic Coalition Party. They don't want this man with so much ability to become embroiled in a court battle and prison. He receives messages from everywhere to leave Iran any way he can. But he believes he has to stay and finish his unfinished work and research, especially now that they've exiled Ayatollah Khomeini. On the morning of March 23, 1964, Dr. Beheshti left Tehran for Qazimiya. A week later, from Iraq to Jordan, and from then on, he goes to Palestine, Syria, and Beirut. But finally, on April the 11th, he leaves Beirut for Hamburg. In Germany, he uses all of his effort in the prosperity of the mosque and the establishment of the Muslim Students' Union in Europe. The mosque grows bigger, and on March 12, 1966, the union officially begins its work. In the spring of 1970, Beheshti is getting ready to travel to Iran. He intends to return to Germany, but thinks there's the possibility that Savak will not allow it. Even though he's tried to train mosque attendees and the University Students' Union to be independent, he still speaks quite frankly during the last session. "Friends, when I'm gone and my trip takes long, don't ever gather around and say that when I was here, you were able to do some things. If the union is effective with the presence of a certain person, even if it's a person like me, it's best that the union does not exist at all. Your organization has to pave its way, be it with me or without me. Find replacements for forces you lose. You are the creations of the God of the world. You are human beings whose battleground is the world. Don't limit yourselves so much. The teacher comes back to Iran. During these days, the political and religious atmosphere in the country is embroiled by many problems. Just as he had guessed, he was banned from leaving the country. It had been a while that the Shah had been informed that religious school books need revisions. The tiring literature in these books, alongside the bland and difficult fiqh education, had turned this period into the most catastrophic period in schools. And the Shah orders the Minister of Education that the compilation of these books be revised. And the minister looks for people who can help with this revision. She reaches a doctor who many say is very educated and insightful. He has a vision and had spent time in Europe. And that man is none other than Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti. The good thing about this is that Mr. Bourghei, the person in charge of the revision at the Ministry of Education, knows the doctor and wants to put together a team made up of Beheshti Bahonar and Golzadeh Ghafori. The doctor likes the work and the team and accepts. Dr. Beheshti is thinking about how to properly teach the main concepts of religion to the students. He even thinks about topics regarding politics and divine leadership. He has no doubt that his cooperation with the Shah's Ministry of Education will make him infamous, but he takes the risk and enters the arena. He says, "I prefer this job to teaching as a university professor as a duty and tradition. I told friends that we will take Islamic Jihad to schools through books and pamphlets and religious studies. The Islam that's about how to live and lifestyle, not the Islam that is part of life." Beheshti set a condition for his cooperation. "My name shouldn't be printed among the authors. My nature does not allow me to have my name in a book that has photos of the Shah and his family." On March 9, 1971, the teacher starts his new work. Beheshti prepares the entirety of the lesson, and Bahonar and Golzadeh are in charge of preparing the content. At times, they ask Mr. Mutahiri for help. The prepared content gets its final approval by the group, and in the end, they give samples of the book to nearly 1,000 people so they could read them and give them their opinions. From university professors to students. The doctor does the job perfectly and with high quality. He even becomes adamant that the photos in the book are in color. The doctor believes the students must definitely see the red flag of Imam Hussein. Slowly, the books reach the students, not only millions of secondary and high school students across the country, but also their teachers become familiar with a new view and outlook of Islam. Later on, authors of the group hold seminars for teachers in different cities. Beheshti himself teaches the entire book to the teachers once. During these sessions, he's sensitive to know how religion teachers react while reading the textbook, what their opinion and criticism of the textbook is, what he does causes the training of a large number of educated individuals of this influential class. Beheshti says, "We were always worried, not out of fear that they'd arrest us and put us in prison or things like that. We were never scared of these things. We were worried that the work we were doing would be left unfinished. With God's help and relying on a well-planned method, we were successful in preparing the last of the books. Exactly after we'd sent that last book for publication, the hellish organization of the Shah found out what we'd done." On April 1, 1974, Selbach writes in one of his documents, "Baeshi's employment in sensitive but secondary positions of the Ministry of Education is not favorable because of his past political activities." This happens exactly a few days after the female minister's appreciation of Mr. Beheshti for his total seriousness and interest in Iran's school books organization. But it's too late. The books have been published, and millions of students across the country have access to them. Savak asks the Ministry of Education for explanations a number of times. But the revolutionary voices of protest can now be heard from every corner of the country. The years from 1970 to 1976 are six influential years of the presence of the teacher in the systemization of the minds of the students of Iran. Dr. Sayed Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, born in Isfahan, a student of Qom's Seminary School and a graduate of University of Tehran, known back then as Maqul and Mangul College, a talented genius and a revolutionary fighter, a cleric who's a teacher who started his struggle against Taghut from small classrooms in a school in Qom, and with effort and hard work, made it to the highest positions of influence in the Ministry of Education. And in the end, he was able to train a generation whose freedom-seeking and fighting injustice spirit was heard by the entire world, the huge revolution in Iran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
African researchers have been warning about monkeypox outbreaks for years. As vaccines are deployed globally, they worry they will be left behind. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Max Kozlov, researcher. This article is published under the heading Monkeypox in Africa, the science the world ignored. Stay tuned for more. After monkeypox cases exploded last month in countries such as Portugal, Spain, and the UK, where outbreaks don't usually occur, a rapid global response followed, including distribution of vaccines in some countries. But monkeypox outbreaks have been occurring in parts of Central and West Africa for years, leaving African researchers there disheartened that such resources have not been made available in their countries, where the disease toll has been highest. They point out that they have long been warning of the potential for the monkeypox virus, which has been behaving in new ways to spread more widely. So far this year, there have been more than 3,000 confirmed monkeypox cases in countries beyond Central and West Africa, but no deaths have been reported. In Africa, however, health officials have reported more than 70 deaths that they suspect were caused by monkeypox. This is probably an undercount because of limited testing and surveillance capacity, says Dimi Ogoina, an infectious disease physician at Niger Delta University in Amasoma, Nigeria. Although he is frustrated by monkeypox having been largely ignored by Western nations until now, Ogoina worries that the current global outbreaks still won't improve the situation for Africa, he says. If we don't draw the attention of the world for this, a lot of solutions will address the problem in Europe but not in Africa. Before this year, only a handful of monkeypox cases had been observed outside Africa. These were linked to the importation of animals from continent or to travelers who had visited. The largest of these outbreaks was a short-lived one in the U.S. in 2003, which stemmed from imported animals and made more than 70 people ill. Meanwhile, some African nations have been dealing with monkeypox outbreaks ever since scientists identified the first human case in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1970. Although researchers still don't know precisely which animals naturally harbor the virus, they do not know that it circulates among many species of rodents and can transmit from animals to humans. A significant outbreak began in Nigeria in 2017, with more than 200 confirmed and 500 suspected cases of monkeypox. Over the past decade, the DRC has seen thousands of suspected cases, as well as hundreds of suspected deaths. In Central Africa, the strain of monkeypox virus that has infected people is more virulent, with a mortality rate of about 10%. For Adelosa Yinka, an epidemiologist at the Nigeria Center for Disease Control in Abuja, the current global outbreaks have brought on a certain sense of déjà vu. Before the 2017 Nigeria outbreak, the virus seemed to be confined to rural areas where hunters would come into contact with animals. It would make its presence known with a fever and distinctive fluid-filled pox lesions on the face, hands, and feet. After 2017, she and other epidemiologists warned that the virus was spreading in an unfamiliar way. It was appearing in urban settings, and infected people sometimes had genital lesions, suggesting that the virus might spread through contact. With the virus now proliferating in Western cities through what seems to be close contact, the world is paying the price for not having responded adequately in 2017, the epidemiologist says. At the same time, researchers have been warning that cases of monkeypox in sub-Saharan Africa have been rising for years. In part, this is because countries stopped giving people vaccines against smallpox, which is caused by variola, a virus that is closely related to the one causes monkeypox. Smallpox was eradicated in 1980 and vaccination was halted, meaning that the percentage of the population vulnerable to it, and thus to monkeypox, has been growing. Since that time, some nations have maintained national stockpiles of smallpox vaccines because health officials have been worried that labs keeping samples of variola might accidentally release it or that the virus might be weaponized. Countries including Canada, France, the UK and the US have been using these stockpiles in a ring vaccination strategy to protect close contacts of a person who is infected with the monkeypox virus. Steve Ahuka, a virologist at the University of Kinshasa, says these vaccines would be useful to tackle the outbreaks in Africa, but countries there don't have large stockpiles, and Western nations haven't donated their shots for use against monkeypox. Both Ahuka and Yunka Ogolunu, scientists, say that if they did have vaccines, they would at the very least recommend inoculating frontline healthcare workers and lab technicians. Other researchers Nature spoke with also said the shots could help to curb monkeypox in Africa if they were given to people with compromised immune systems and those who frequently encounter wildlife.
Yani
Bazaar.
Whether man-made or not, food can have fascinating backstories. Products usually take a long journey before they end up on the dining table. Nevertheless, the food industry follows several golden rules that have helped it steadily grow over time. The most important of these is continuous product innovation and improved production processes to reduce costs and wastage. Others involve packaging and product accessibility, but probably the king of all rules is the taste that drives the food industry.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will be exploring the food industry and its related agricultural markets. We wanted to see how the food sector has expanded over the years and what companies are doing to increase their profits. So let's check out the Tasty Grub.
To become more familiar with how much work goes into food production, we visited Golha Food Industries. It was established nearly a century ago, and its products are now a household name. It produces hundreds of items in seven categories, such as dried legumes and fruit, spices and canned products. It also takes great pride in its healthy product line, including gluten-free flour products. This producer has devoted a lot of attention to the packaging of its products. Due to its diverse product list, it purchases such materials as cans, plastic, and cardboard to design the appropriate type of storage systems for distribution. The company has a massive daily output due to its expansive production facilities. Most of the work is done by automated machines, but the fine details are handled by experienced staff. All production processes start when raw material enters the company. These materials are first tested for quality before hitting the production floors, most of which are domestically supplied. After being tested, the material is sent to various closed circuit machines for processing. Then it is time for sorting and more quality control tests before packaging.
Food production is a very sensitive process requiring many checks and controls that guarantee the final product is safe for consumption. And production machines play an essential role as they reduce errors and maintain constant output results. Plus, many of these machines have been domestically engineered, whereas they were previously imported at high prices.
This company has a highly equipped quality control and research and development lab. It's where many new products are created and food safety standards are controlled. Moreover, the staff in this department implement food sciences to make innovative products. It might be interesting to know that this department also has some of the best food tasters. This producer has been awarded Best Research and Development Department in Food Production for many consecutive years. Among its many achievements, it has also been awarded the certificate of favored brand by customers. This wouldn't be possible without adhering to strict national and international food safety and production management standards. Following such standards has helped it maintain its export share in the global food market. With years of experience, this company has grown such that it provides thousands of employment opportunities, both directly and indirectly. It also has thousands of agencies and stores all over the country. Plus, its products can also be purchased online. As part of its future vision, this company is looking to increase its market share both domestically and abroad. It also has long-term plans to increase production and improve the production process for efficiency.
The Iranian food industry has taken giant strides away from its traditional production methods. Industry participants say using food sciences and new technologies has helped the food industry grow faster than before. Never more than now has food been more accessible. In fact, it only requires a touch of a few buttons to receive it at home. Therefore, food packaging is a critical part of the production.
Over the last decade, there has been a great emphasis on developing packaging for the food industry. This is because Iran indigenized many machines needed to process and produce food items such as deli meats, beverages, pickles, and so much more. Proper packaging also increases shelf life, which is important for consumers. Previously, food items such as spices and dairy products were purchased bulk from customers abroad due to a lack of packaging. While exporting items in bulk has benefits, it's not as profitable as selling prepackaged foodstuff. So, in addition to adding value to raw products such as meat, companies have also designed attractive packaging to contain food in more manageable portions. Such a strategy increases not only product quality, but also food safety, which helps producers meet international export standards. This trend also helps companies with branding
and has created job opportunities for designers.
As you probably already know, the food industry is heavily dependent on production in the agriculture sector. So it's no surprise that the agriculture sector holds the pulse of national food security and food exports. Plus, it is one of the only sectors that has been barely impacted by the US-imposed sanctions and the global coronavirus outbreak. That was horrible.
We looked at some figures from the Ministry of Agriculture to see how this sector is doing. Last year, around 6 million tons of agricultural and foodstuff products were exported. Trade of these products raked in roughly $4 billion. Pistachio, saffron, and confectionery products topped the export charts in value during that period. Other agriculture sectors, such as livestock, poultry, and aquaculture, have also generated millions of dollars in exports. Last year, nearly 450,000 tons of these items were sent to markets in neighboring regions worth $500 million. Agriculture accounts for 8% of the country's gross domestic product. It might be interesting to know that around half of Iran's total non-oil trade comes from this sector. That's all based on data from Iran's Ministry of Agriculture. According to Iran's Customs Administration, the total non-oil trade value rose nearly 40% last year. Over 120 million tons of non-oil products worth $72 billion were traded with other countries in that period. Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences.
We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out.
Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward-thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook.
Given its large oil reserves, it's not surprising that Iran has an ever-expanding polymer industry. Various manufacturing sectors heavily depend on petrochemical products, such as home appliances, plastics, and even textiles. The government aims to further develop polymer industries and other downstream sectors of the oil industry. Doing so would increase revenues through exports and help bolster the country's economy.
According to the National Polymer and Petrochemical Institute, Iran ranks first in the region and globally ranks 18th in polymer production. Moreover, output in this sector accounts for over 2% of the country's non-oil exports. We looked at some figures from the National Association of Polymer and Plastic Industries to get an idea of how this market is doing. Well over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced each year. Half of this amount is domestically used, and the other half is exported, valued at $3 billion. In addition, exports of products made from polymers in complementary industries are worth around $2 billion. However, industry participants say that the country is not using all of its production capacity. Figures from the National Association of Polymer and Plastic Industries show this sector has a production capacity of 20 million tons, meaning around 14 million tons of this total production potential are not being used. The government plans to double current production levels over the next 4 years to increase exports. Officials say meeting this goal will make Iran self-sufficient in polymer production.
Now, polymers are the primary materials